And I mean, ultimately, contemporary cinemas require less space. Technologies have changed. And so actually, it would definitely would not be a stretch of the imagination to suggest that a lot of these could be brought back to their former glory in some sense, with actually minimal investment. And I think it maybe just needs a certain shift in mindset for people to believe that the cinema is a valuable civic space. It is a valuable cultural space, and it warrants investment.
Daily's James Taylor Foster on the perils and pitfalls of bringing an old cinema back to life. We'll speak to the experts and uncover the secrets of building a picture palace fit for the modern age. Today on The Cinema Show.
The most important thing to think about was how to create the hotel whilst really respecting the architecture.
The architect Jason Flanagan explains how he respectfully turned one of London's oldest theatres into an entirely new structure. And
I mean, it was really interesting because for Curzon, Bloomsbury, we were very fortunate that our client Curzon were happy for us to use, say, Tarkovsky as a reference, you know, and we looked at something like Nostalgia or scenes from Stalker.
Takeru Shimazaki takes us behind the scenes of his design for the Curzon Bloomsbury Cinema. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. It's the 31st of August 1908, and the doors to London's newest theatre, the Tottenham Palace, have just been opened for the very first time. Designed in a Grecian style by architects Wilson and Long, it had been envisioned as a live variety theatre. But while many doubted the rise of the moving image, the golden age of cinema was fast approaching, and by 1922, the Tottenham Palace was showing movies. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Walking by the Tottenham Palace Theatre today feels a little bit like visiting a ghost. Movies haven't been shown here since 1968, when the cinema closed and the large space was converted for use as a bingo hall. It's since been converted again and now functions as a church. Yet despite its nearly 50-year hibernation, the building still maintains that special blend of majestic intrigue that grand old theatres so often convey. The vast majority of the theatre is still intact, making this a relatively easy conversion should anyone with deep enough pockets and crazy enough dreams come along. But a return to the glory days of the Tottenham Palace is, while not impossible, quite unlikely. Changes in viewing habits combined with a massive shift in London's socio-economic makeup have basically ensured that a theatre in this part of the city doesn't make any business sense. But does that mean that the theatre is headed for an inevitable demise? A crumbling, nostalgic symbol of old London? Well, that's where our story today begins. Have you ever wondered why adult bookstores are so often located down a narrow stairwell below street level? It's not just about hiding away from prying eyes. Whether or not you've ever visited one of these underground shops, and don't worry, you don't have to say so now, you might have noticed that quite often they're located in what could be an old screening room. Many of them still have a working cinema attached, though they generally don't screen the kind of films we'll ever be discussing here. Well, not all cinemas are born equal. In a former life, those underground single-screen picture houses often specialised in smaller, cheaper films, cartoons or productions out of Hollywood's so-called Poverty Row studios. Or sometimes, a constant rotation of newsreels, a sort of early precursor to the 24-hour news network. As the Golden Age faded and television peaked, those that weren't converted into screening houses of the XXX genre often became live music venues or were simply absorbed into the street-level retail spaces above. Sometimes, however, much of the original architecture remained in place, if somewhat obscured. Giving an old cinema new life doesn't necessarily mean demolition, but it is a tricky business. James Taylor Foster is the European Editor-at-Large of architecture website ArcDaily.
Well, first of all, you're totally right. I mean, the thing about a cinema is that it's a big, open, rectangular piece of space. And as cities urbanize and they become denser, these become extremely valuable. One comes to mind, like, very specifically. It's a very unique case. It's in the middle of Canareggio in Venice. It's called the Cinema Italia. It's this amazingly vast, large, cavernous space, which was once a series of cinemas and is now being turned into Venice's largest supermarket. But it's a wonderful example of how valuable these sorts of spaces are and how easy they are to transform into something of convenience. The real challenge comes, as you say, is when you have to transform this space into something which maybe has cultural meaning or indeed becomes a cinema again. Because the idea of a cinema is a kind of a gathering space. People don't really go to the cinema by themselves. It's a collective experience, and it's an important collective experience, I think, especially in a time in which screens are becoming smaller and the way that we consume media is becoming more dispersed and fragmented. I mean, the age-old kind of metaphor is that there was the hearth in the house, which everybody gathered around. Then there was the TV, which everybody gathered around. And now everyone's in their own bedrooms or on the couch with the tiny iPhone screens watching Netflix. And this notion of gathering around a piece of cinema has been lost. And so actually, I feel that as civic cultural spaces, the cinema is becoming more and more important. And this unique typology, which was built in the 50s and 60s and onwards, which has since become derelict, is becoming valuable again, not just as a cavernous space in the middle of the city, which can become a church, or a supermarket, but actually as a cinema again. At the same time, we're dealing with a situation in which the level of effort which has to go into restoring a space of these sort of sizes and usually of architectural significance takes a great deal of investment. So you need the right client, you need the right person.
Good evening and welcome to television.
The rise of television as the prime source of family entertainment saw many cinemas shut their doors, especially those not in the business of screening A-list Hollywood productions. And it was often the ones located in prime retail areas that suffered the worst fate. As soon as the doors closed, the seats were torn out and fixtures auctioned off or simply thrown away. There, of course, lies another challenge. Those grand old picture palaces that somehow have managed to stay standing have often sat idle while their surrounding urban areas underwent massive changes.
There are amazing palatial complexes of enormous architectural significance lying throughout Detroit, which really I don't think they'll ever serve that function again, because as you said, the entire structure around them has been lost, and a lot of things would have to fall back in place to make these viable civic cultural gathering spaces again. At the same time, there's a potential that they could kickstart and ignite and act as a catalyst for this sort of thing. But it does require a very specific client, as I said, because I'm not entirely sure whether they make money. I'm not sure whether the business model is in place and therefore whether the incentive is in place. At the same time, I know so many architects who would do an amazing job of bringing these spaces back to life, because ultimately, the project which immediately comes to mind in recent years was not necessarily a picture house, but it was a concert hall come picture house in Liverpool, which was renovated by a London-based practice called Caruso St. John in an amazing way. It took an amazing combination of client, of architect, of the financial impetus, and an amazing community spirit within Liverpool to bring this back to life. But it's an amazing showcase of what can be done when the imperatives are there.
Marilyn
Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell are welcomed by George Bowser, manager of the Fox West Coast Theaters, as they arrive to make their imprints in the famous concrete of Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood.
The thing about these structures is they're usually, as I mentioned earlier, large rectangular boxes in which the facade is the most important thing, so the actual part of the building which faces the street. And in many of these cases, you find incredible interiors, you find incredible facades, and that's it. And so when it actually comes to identifying the architectural significance of these buildings, they sometimes miss out on the listings simply because they don't have a kind of wholesome integrity to them in the kind of traditional sense of when you look at, for example, a turn of the century Gothic building in the City of London, where it is, you know, you can look at it and say, well, this is through and through a building of architectural significance. It's not usually the case. And so if they avoid listing and then somebody comes in and wants to turn it into whatever it might be, because the options are pretty much endless when you've got a rectangular box, they often take out all the internal structure, because the structure of the cinema is designed to have a large roof span to kind of create, so you can fill it. And often all there is a foyer and some balconies and some seats and a raking. They don't have complex interior spaces. And this is a problem because it's so easy just to eradicate it all and start from scratch. When I talk about the kind of simplicity of these structures, obviously it works both ways. Yes, of course, you can pull it all out. You can maintain the ornamentation, which seems to make sense often in the foyer, but they're able to be reinvigorated by the same typology again with actually relative ease.
James Taylor Foster, the European Editor-at-Large of Arc Daily. So what happens when a cinema simply can't stay in business any longer? Is it only a matter of time before the wrecking ball moves in? Well, not necessarily. We'll find out how one grand old picture palace found new life in a respectfully modern way. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. The Cannes Film Festival is just over 1 month away, but the organisers have already started their annual delivery of surprises. During the unveiling of the official selection this week, many were shocked to find two television series set for screenings as part of a special 70th anniversary section. Audiences will get a sneak peek at two episodes of David Lynch's upcoming return of Twin Peaks, as well as a couple of episodes from season 2 of Jane Campion's series Top of the Lake, featuring Nicole Kidman. But the surprises didn't end there. Nicole Kidman is also starring in one of the films in competition, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, by director Yorgos Lanthimos, in his follow-up to the strange 2015 film The Lobster. Colin Farrell stars alongside Kidman and, believe it or not, Alicia Silverstone.
Oh, as if!
Other films sure to be attracting attention include Wonderstruck, from director Todd Haynes, starring Julianne Moore, and the documentary Sea Sorrow, in which actress Vanessa Redgrave jumps into the director's chair for some historical perspective on the current crisis for migrants here in Europe and across the world. Get yourself into the mood for a movie by signing up to MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. Sample a whole month for free right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. We've heard about the challenges that often come with bringing a theatre up to speed with modern viewing habits, but what happens when bringing a grand old picture palace back to life as a modern business simply isn't feasible? That was the scenario faced by Jason Flanagan when his architecture firm, Flanagan Lawrence, was given the brief of redeveloping an enormous old cinema here in London.
There's nothing quite like it anywhere else in the world. And incidentally, its equipment is second to none. It's the new home of Britain's National Film Theatre. And the stars, Jack Hawkins among them, are arriving for the
original. Shepherd's Bush Pavilion was built in 1923. The architect was Frank Beresey. And it was, when it was built, when it opened, it was the kind of the golden age of cinema. And at the time it opened, we believe it was the biggest cinema outside of the United States. It was, you know, in the high 2000s, nearly 3,000 seats. It was an absolutely massive auditorium. But over the years, it had started to fall into disrepair. So during the 60s and 70s, it was converted. It had been badly bombed during the Second World War, and a lot of the internal decoration had been stripped out of the auditorium, so there wasn't a great deal left. And then it was actually subdivided into two rooms, one on top of the other, and there was a bingo hall at ground level, and there was what was left of the cinema at the upper level. And so by the time we came to start looking at the building, it was in quite a state of disrepair. It was on what is now known as Historic England. It was on English Heritage's Buildings at Risk register. And there had been plans to demolish it in the 80s and build a new office building. But the building was listed. It was Grade 2 listed. So when we started looking at it, people had had a look to see whether they could convert it into apartments and all sorts of things. But the proposal that we were looking at was to convert it into a hotel. And eventually we did come up with a design that created a 317-bed hotel. And the most important thing to think about was how to create the hotel whilst really respecting the architecture, Verity's architecture, which is this quite restrained, stripped-back, quite austere classicism. You know, it's a very, very strong building. The pavilion literally sits and holds that end of Shepherd's Bush Green. And one of the trickiest parts of the project was the fact that the upper part of the auditorium of the cinema, as it rises above the facade that faces Shepherd's Bush Green, was solid brick. So you've got about three stories of solid brickwork. And then on top of that, the barrel-vaulted roof was a concrete roof covered in bitumen. So completely solid. So the biggest challenge for us was, how do you actually get light through that treatment? And in all of the conversations with the heritage groups, it was critical that we retained the form and materiality of that volume of the building. And eventually we came out with a strategy to keep the form of the building, but replace it with new materials. So we replaced the concrete roof, the solid concrete roof, with a glass barrel vault. And that glass barrel vault slides down behind a facade screen that acts like a veil, which is a series of terracotta extruded baguettes, which are the same colour and size of the brickwork. But when you're inside the rooms looking out, it's like being behind a quite large-scale Venetian blind. So as you're wandering around outside the building, you look up, it still looks solid. It still looks similar to the kind of the red brick it always was. But actually, it's very open and transparent and light when you're on the inside. So that was the biggest challenge, really. There wasn't much left of the actual cinema, given all of the different conversions and the damage that had taken place at the end of the Second World War. So what we were looking to do was to work with the plan form of the building, keep the entrance, keep the foyer, and then where you used to go into the cinema, what you do now is you walk into a central atrium, which is this fantastic space, which is the heart of the hotel. And there are some rooms that look back into that, and that rises eight stories. You still get a sense of the drama and the height of the building, even though it's completely, totally changed its function. And aesthetically, there are references to the golden age of cinema. When you go into the atrium, for example, there are these golden hooped balconies that wrap around it, which are acoustic panels. They mean that you can have a pleasant conversation in the bar at the bottom of the atrium. But what it does is it kind of slightly recalls ocean liners of the 20s and 30s and takes you back to that age. There's something about the glamour that we were trying to recreate. What was fascinating about the building was the architecture itself. It was what was remaining. And working with that, Verity's architecture, what we could discover about the interiors, because very little was left. So we spent time in the RIBA's library, digging out photographs, looking for ideas about internal features that could create an echo to what was once the interior of the building. So that was a strong influence for us. And I think that has come through in the new architecture. So whilst the interiors are very different to the outside and very modern, there is a resonance. And you do feel that the inside and the outside of the building are linked, even though it's got a totally new function. But as you walk through the Triumphal Arch, which was, you know, the entrance into the Picture Palace for over 2,500 people when it was at its prime, that now is the entrance into a rather glamorous lobby of the foyer of the hotel. So we're trying to use the spatial sequence of the building in as far as we can, in a way that's very similar to the way the building worked originally. And I think it's about respecting the original fabric as far as possible. And it is difficult with certainly the larger auditoria to make sure that they can come back in the same way as a larger auditoria, because cinema's changed. The way that people watch films has changed. And there's only so many large cinemas can still function effectively, economically. And in some cases, you can turn them into auditoria for different uses. But I think in this instance, it's been a successful conversion of the building that respects the architecture, but transforms it into a totally different use.
Jason Flanagan from Flanagan Lawrence Architects. Jason's firm is currently working on an extension to the Shepherd's Bush Pavilion Hotel, which is also set to update a former cinema. Finally today, last year we heard from the architect Takeru Shimazaki about how he turned the old Renoir Art House here in London into one of the city's most impressive cinematic marvels. His design for the Curzon Bloomsbury takes its cues from the films of Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky. Here's Takeru Shimazaki explaining how it all came together.
I think it started even when I was studying at UCL. I was actually referring a lot to photographers like Man Ray films or even Moholy Nagy films. And my tutor, actually, at the Bartlett at UCL encouraged us to watch quite a lot of Tarkovsky. So, you know, the first class we had at UCL in our diploma, first lesson, we sat down and the tutor started showing us Nostalgia. And we were like, oh my God, what is this? You know, we sat there for hours, didn't understand some of the things, to be honest, at the beginning. But the tutor was really patiently explaining to us about composition of space. So when you have a frame or an image and you have a window with activities happening on the outside with sort of water drips just in front of you, and then there's a door opens and then somebody enters. And so he was trying to, I think our tutor and us, we discussed a lot about these kind of movements in space, events, light, and obviously with Tarkovsky's sense of time. So there's a big discussion about how do we capture time when we are designing architecture, and how does that materialize in the finished building. We also looked at music, influence of music, like Xenakis with Le Corbusier on La Tourette. So these modernist buildings with sort of the rhythmic window mullions and structures. And we went to see Xenakis' concert, Philip Glass. You know, we studied those things for learning how to design a building, and in terms of rhythm, time, space. I mean, it was really interesting because for Curzon Bloomsbury, we were very fortunate that our client Curzon were happy for us to use, say, Tarkovsky as a reference, you know, and we looked at something like Nostalgia or scenes from Stalker. So from our point of view, we watched the film many times and we froze at a certain frame. And with this project, we started to look at different scenes, different frames, depending on the space you are in. So the sequence from the ground outside coming in through the main entrance kiosk on the ground floor with the bar and the waiting area and the foyer. I think we were very, very conscious of color, material palette, light. How does light travel from ground to -1 to -2, then through the corridors to the auditorium? So we wanted to immerse the audience on that journey, because cinema is essentially escapism. So we wanted the audience to feel like they're part of a film, almost part of a scene. So we looked at many different samples of concrete, wall finishes, how light would reflect onto a certain type of metal or glass. Would we keep it transparent? Would we actually coat it with something? And even on the ground floor, for example, we did the whole structure in glass to actually pay homage to what was there before. But also, we thought that was a bit too stark, so we kind of soften it with this kind of very gentle translucent fabric, white fabric curtain all around the room to mediate between outside and inside. I think the key word we had was the word evocative. So we're not imposing a certain type of a feeling, but evoking the audience to whatever they like to feel, but it's just giving them that space to explore all sorts of different feelings when you go to watch a film. But I do believe that buildings can have this power. I mean, we visited many buildings during the design of this. One example would be some architectural ruins in Sicily, or an old villa, or where it has these kind of crumbling plaster wall, or something with a sense of time, something with rust, decay. But also the toilets in Curzon Bloomsbury are a kind of sense of, you know, it's the opposite. So it's very bright, it's very white, it has these marble tops and floor. And I think we wanted to give this kind of very pristine sense of, almost enlightenment, the opposite of the moody, darker spaces. But we very much believed in evoking feelings throughout the architecture, which is quite rare, actually. You don't see that often now in contemporary work.
The architect Takeru Shimazaki. And that's all for today's program. Next week, we'll preview a new film recalling the work of one of the world's most admired erotic artists, Tom of Finland.
The main motivation is just to tell a good story, and I think it should function as that. You shouldn't make an agenda film. I think if a film is an agenda, it usually fails on the second act by last.
Today's show was mixed and edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you happen to get your audio. The Cinema Show is, of course, back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.
That's why God made the movie. Well, I laid around in my swaddling clothes until the doctor came and turned out the light. My bag and my name tag stole away into the night, hoping things would work out right. And that's why God made the movie. Say you will, say you will, say you'll take.